Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, the Filmmakers Collaborative podcast. I'm your host, Michael Azevedo. On this episode, I'm speaking with documentary filmmakers Anna Moot Levin and Laura Green about the second in their three-film Matter of Mind series. Their first film looked at ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Their latest film, which debuts on PBS's Independent Lens on April 8th, tells the story of three people, a political cartoonist, a mother-turned-boxing coach, and an optician, as they navigate their lives with resourcefulness and determination in the face of a different degenerative illness, Parkinson's disease. Here's a brief preview of the film.
I first noticed that I had a tremor in my leg, and that was the first sign there was danger on the horizon.
I was diagnosed with Parkinson's at the age of 39.
Parkinson's has multiple symptoms which are staggering in their breadth.
It's exhausting. Holding it together is more exhausting than the disease itself.
You never know what's going to happen if you don't give up. You might live.
Anna Moot Levin is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, and editor with a passion for stories about health and healthcare. Her debut documentary, The Providers, also aired on Independent Lens in 2019. She is also an associate producer of the Academy Award-winning documentary Inside Job. She's based in Brooklyn. Laura Green is an award-winning documentary director and editor based in San Francisco. She collaborated with Anna on The Providers and is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University. Making Media Now is sponsored by Filmmakers Collaborative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting media makers from across the creative spectrum. From providing fiscal sponsorship to presenting an array of informative and educational programs, Filmmakers Collaborative supports creatives at every step in their journey. To learn more, visit filmmakerscollab.org. And as always, if you're enjoying this podcast, please do like, follow, share, and leave a review. Everything helps. Now on to my conversation with Anna Moot Levin and Laura Green. Hello, Anna Moot Levin and Laura Green. Welcome to Making Media Now.
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure to be speaking with both of you, and we're here today to talk about your film, Matter of Mind, My Parkinson's. And it is the second in a series of three documentaries focusing on neurodegenerative diseases. And Anna, I'd like to just start out, maybe if you could talk to us a little bit about what you had in mind when you were outlining this as a three-film series, and then maybe also for the purposes of definition, what is a neurodegenerative disease?
As our team was developing this project over several years, we felt that although neurodegenerative diseases have some commonalities, that each one has also specific experiences. And so we felt that it would, the best format would be to have three separate films on three separate diseases so that we could really go deeply into the experience of each illness. And so neurodegenerative diseases are sort of what they sound like. They involve neurons that degenerate over time. And so neurodegenerative diseases are progressive diseases, meaning that symptoms get worse over time, and they involve in some way some type of neurons. So, for example, our first film in the series focused on ALS. And so ALS specifically impacts motor neurons that control movement. And so ALS, the symptoms are very much connected to movement, or what becomes lack of movement, that people become paralyzed over time. And so for Parkinson's disease, Parkinson's specifically affects neurons that are involved in dopamine. And dopamine is involved in many systems of the body and brain. And so that's why we see a wide variety of symptoms with Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease impacts movement, but it also impacts speech, it impacts digestion, it impacts mood. We had one doctor during our research process who said that you learn about Parkinson's and you learn about all parts of the body and all systems, because it's such a complex disease that has a wide variety of symptoms.
And Laura, what is sort of the current state of play regarding Parkinson's in the U.S. in terms of how many people in the U.S. are thought to be living with Parkinson's currently, and on an annual basis, about how many folks are being diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Yeah, currently right now, there are about 1 million people living in the U.S. with Parkinson's. And I think one of the things that is really important to be aware of, and that is part of the genesis of this series, is that with the aging of the U.S. population, these neurodegenerative diseases are starting to affect more and more people, which, you know, I want to be careful to say is not because they're becoming more common, but rather because of demographics. But it really means that for us as a society, as children, as family members, as caregivers, we're seeing these illnesses start to affect more and more people.
So say a little more about that in terms, you know, the relationship between the aging population in general. Parkinson's, my understanding is that there is a greater prevalence of incidences of Parkinson's with people in a particular age demographic.
Yes. So in general, many neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which are the two that affect the largest number of people, are more common as people age. And so when we look at a population that on the whole is getting older, we're starting to see a greater prevalence of these diseases. ALS is also more common as people age, but the age of onset is actually significantly younger. I don't know if I can remember off the top of my head what the average age of onset is, but I want to say it's more like 55. And it actually has it's less common before that age, but also less common after that age. And you can see I'm talking with my hands, although I know this is an audio podcast. But then with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, it's more that it continues to increase as the population gets older and older. So it's a different pattern.
And Anna, when you were setting out to make this film, how do you go about finding subjects? How do you go about finding people that are willing to have their story told? You know, when you're being depicted on screen, dealing with all of the challenges that a disease like Parkinson's presents, you know, it's not always a pretty picture. It's not always a comforting picture. And certainly if you were somebody who was self-conscious, that most definitely could be an issue. So talk to me a little bit about your film focuses on three individuals, a political cartoonist, a mother turned boxing coach, and an optician. Talk to me a little bit about how you found these folks and what type of relationship had to be established between filmmakers and film subjects.
So for each film in the series, we spend about 6 months talking to families and individuals impacted by Parkinson's, about 50, 60 families in different parts of the country going through different types of experiences to really learn and gather information about, you know, what are the key themes and challenges that we see emerging from people's stories. And so from there, we really think about telling three different stories that are going to represent different kinds of experiences. And in particular, in this series, we're really focusing on underrepresented experiences. So for example, Peter Dunlap Scholl, who's a political cartoonist, he lives in Alaska, and access to healthcare is really challenging for him and for many populations in more rural communities in this country. And at the same time, we were really interested in telling the story of a woman living with Parkinson's disease, because women with Parkinson's are much less represented in the media for this disease, and as well as in research. And then with Juan in Brooklyn, we were really excited about telling a story that followed someone through the process of getting DBS surgery, which is a treatment option for Parkinson's. And so we specifically were looking for someone who's going to be going through that experience. And with each of the families, we really work to build trust over time. We have many conversations before we come to film with them about what our intentions are, what our vision is for the film, what they can expect, as well as we're in very close communication about the schedule and what we're planning to film on each shoot. And so, you know, over time, we really build a lot of trust and understanding. And we also, we're looking to film with people who are excited about sharing their stories in some way, in spite of how hard that can be. People who see the value in sharing their stories because they themselves felt alone, and they imagine that someone seeing the film, it could really help them.
So, yeah, so you mentioned Peter, who is in Alaska and has to go to Washington State to seek out better care. Veronica is the mother, and she was diagnosed with Parkinson's when she was pregnant, and we meet her 12 years into her journey with Parkinson's, and Juan, who's the optician, who is in Brooklyn. And so you're profiling, of course, these individuals, but their families and the people who are close to them are also very much involved. And talk to me just a little bit about that, because, you know, you need sign on from the subjects themselves. But I would imagine there's instances where the people very close to the subjects who are dealing with Parkinson's day in and day out might sometimes feel protective around how they're portrayed mm-hmm. at their most vulnerable. Laura, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think just the first thing to say is that, you know, we talk a lot about the fact that an individual has Parkinson's, but the family is also living with Parkinson's, you know, and that those are very different experiences, but they're hard experiences for everybody involved. I'm not sure if I don't recall an instance of somebody else in the family sort of feeling protective. I think that mostly they recognize that the person that's living with Parkinson's really wants to participate and they want to support them. I would say more sometimes the partner may be a little bit more shy or may feel less sort of driven to share their story. And so we have to sort of, you know, talk to them and see what they're comfortable with and all that. And then, of course, there's instances like Issa, Veronica's daughter, who just sees the camera and is like, I'm ready. I'm ready for my close-up. Please bring it on.
Yeah, she definitely was.
Yeah, but I think, you know, just to sort of echo what Anna says, there's a lot of people that when they're dealing with something really hard, like an illness, you know, they don't want a camera in their life. And then there's a group of people that find it really, I would say, cathartic, you know, and that's like that's always our goal, is to find the people that want to be part of the process, that want to make the film with us. And so I think that in general, the families and partners are also on board, although sometimes they are a little bit more shy, I would say. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anna, you mentioned a process that is that's an option for some people who have Parkinson's. You referred to it as DBS, which stands for deep brain stimulation. Talk to me about what the benefits of a successful DBS procedure is, and what are the risks involved, and what did you discover through this film? The three subjects were having to essentially weigh when they considered the possibility of undergoing this process.
Yes, so deep brain stimulation, as we say in the film, can be thought of a little bit like a pacemaker for the brain. And so the surgery involves a planting electrodes into the brain that provide ongoing electrical pulses in everyday life. So it's an implant into the brain. And so not everyone with Parkinson's is a good candidate for this surgery. It involves a long evaluation, and the surgery is best for people who have a certain set of symptoms as well as other factors. At the same time, this surgery is still underutilized. There are many more people that could benefit from it that aren't getting the surgery. And so we felt like it was really important to raise awareness about it as part of the film. And so as part of the surgery, you get this extensive evaluation and then the electrodes are turned on. And that's kind of the moment where you can see the changes in the symptoms happening. And so DBS can specifically improve motor symptoms, especially tremor, which can be a central symptom for many people with Parkinson's disease. And so as we see in the film, when Juan receives the surgery, he really benefits from it and he's able to walk and move more easily. At the same time, there are many symptoms that the surgery can't address, such as balance. We see in Peter's story, he's had the surgery and yet he still has issues with balance and he's falling. And as well as, you know, the whole other range of non-motor symptoms that we talked about that DBS can't address.
Yeah, the sequence in the film after Juan has the surgery and the sort of the before and after is being illustrated is breathtaking. It's breathtaking from the standpoint of being a viewer, and you really feel the relief, almost the miraculous shock that Juan and his partner feel also. I'm curious, are there any longitudinal studies that either of you are aware of around what's happening 3-5 years out for people who have had DBS?
Off the top of my head, I don't know about longitudinal studies, but what I can speak about is that early on in the development of DBS, 20-25 years ago, they used to recommend it for a much smaller group of patients, and later on when they were more advanced. And what they realized over time is that for people really that have sort of tremor dominant Parkinson's, having this intervention and having it really early can give them a much longer window of having their symptoms really under control. So we worked with some really fantastic advisors who are movement disorder specialists. And so we spoke to them extensively about, the way that we presented these things, but I don't have the studies off the top of my head. But, there's still this pretty big gap between the number of people that they think DBS would help and the number of people that are getting it. And that's partially because the number of people that they recommend it for has grown a lot. And then anecdotally, we can say that if you look, for example, at Peter's story, I think him getting DBS early in his journey and being able to stay active and exercise, and keep drawing has really helped his progression.
What are the trends showing in terms of prevalence of Parkinson's among the U.S. population and also treatment and how that treatment has been contributing to longevity in terms of how long are people now living with Parkinson's compared to perhaps how long they may have been living with Parkinson's 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Unfortunately, there really haven't been many breakthroughs in terms of treatment for Parkinson's in the past few decades. Really, the biggest breakthrough has been the recognition that exercise can be very effective in terms of managing the illness, and maybe the only way to actually slow the progression of the illness. And so programs have developed across the country, such as the one that Veronica participates in, that are exercise classes designed specifically for people with Parkinson's, because that has been shown again and again in research to be really effective. And I think that, unfortunately, there just haven't been new developments in treatment otherwise. And it's really important that we continue to pursue research and treatments for this illness, because, you know, with the aging population, the prevalence is getting greater, as well as, it's hard to say definitely, but there is some evidence that there's certain environmental factors that can impact the prevalence of Parkinson's. For example, in the Central Valley of California, there's a particularly high incidence of Parkinson's, and it's suspected that that is related to chemicals and pesticides. And so there are some environmental factors potentially at work that are also increasing the prevalence of Parkinson's in the modern era.
You know, I think a lot of people, when they think about Parkinson's and their awareness of Parkinson's, they think of Michael J. Fox, probably the most well-known person who is, you know, has been living with Parkinson's for well over 25 years now, if I have that timing correct. What's the correlation between the notoriety of an individual suffering from a disease, say like Parkinson's, and not just public knowledge of the disease itself, but perhaps correlation between that and people donating to research funds, to just greater press coverage of something like this? How do researchers feel about the greater notoriety for a disease like that has a celebrity attached to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Michael J. Fox has done just incredible work with Parkinson's. You know, we find as filmmakers, there's been a real lack of representation, you know, around the illness. We can't say single-handedly, but, you know, certainly at the front edge of most awareness about Parkinson's is Michael J. Fox. And so I think that for researchers, I'm not a researcher, but I think generally, you know, people being more aware of the disease is really helpful. And it's helpful in a couple of ways. One is for funding of research, of course, but the other thing is that people may be able to go see a doctor to try to pursue early diagnosis. You know, they may seek out a movement disorder specialist if they have Parkinson's and it progresses and they know more about it. And also, I think that there's a tremendous amount of work to be done in terms of reducing stigma, you know, and that there are a lot of people, you know, that don't feel comfortable, you know, with the way that they're treated if they have Parkinson's, you know. And so I think that getting people out there that are very vocal and very public is incredibly important at all of those levels. And, you know, certainly, you know, we are just amazed by the work he's done.
And each of you have made documentary films prior to embarking on this Matter of Mind series. I'm curious about the sort of the standard of rigor and how that might change when you decide to go into making a series of films about these diseases, you know, the diseases that have such a real life, quite often life and death importance, you know, obviously for the people who are suffering from them, but also just the general public. In terms of information, you know, as documentary filmmakers, I'm sure you hold yourself to a high standard anyway, in terms of rigor of research and veracity and detail and so forth. But I'm curious, when you're delving into covering diseases that are so life altering, how that ups the ante, so to speak, in your methodology and in your process.
As Laura mentioned, we always work with medical expert advisors who review the film, and we get feedback on them, and we continue to be in touch with them throughout the process as we have factual questions about accuracy. At the same time, for each of our films, we go through an extensive research process before we begin making the film. And we did this similarly, Laura and I, with our last film, The Providers, about rural healthcare. We really dug deep into the world of rural healthcare and spoke to many rural healthcare practitioners about the state of rural healthcare. And so there's all those factual concerns, but then there's many ethical concerns about how do we represent people who are in very vulnerable situations, and we're filming people in very intimate ways. And so that really involves a lot of conversations about communicating what we're going to film, asking the film participants what they're comfortable with. You know, do they have any specific boundaries that they'd like us to maintain, and really just keeping that communication very, very open.
Given the often pretty long production timelines with documentary films, things just take a lot of time sometimes. What happens when, how does that work, I guess, is my question. How does that work in, when you're dealing with medical issues, in terms of, you know, you could be in the 11th hour of completion and some breakthrough is discovered, or you could be in the 11th hour of completion and something, some real upheaval has taken place with one of your subjects. I assume you've taken that into consideration, but I'm curious around the challenges that the long production timelines in documentary film versus if this were, you know, if you were working on network news or something and you were going to package a piece and it had to be ready in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think it's a really great question. And I think that the first place where we really address that is in our research process, because we're really saying, you know, this film is headed for broadcast in a window that we sort of have an idea of, which is a little different than a lot of documentary films, which are really open-ended. And so we are sort of looking to say, is something going on in your life that we can jump into and be with you for this important window, you know, during this? So a lot of that is really trying to find people and then looking at representation, you know, which three stories during this window are going to give people a complete, you know, sort of picture. So I think a lot of it is that process. There are issues that come up. A really excellent example is that Veronica did decide to have DBS after we completed filming. And so we had, you know, sort of a lot of discussion about that. In a way, we were sort of stuck, you know, because the film was wrapped at that point. But we also felt good about the way that we depicted that, because even though Veronica didn't get DBS in the film, somebody else did. And so there was sort of a balanced storytelling around that. But there have been difficult moments where we sort of had to say, you know, this is the part of your story we've captured. We hope that we've left the end of it, you know, the end of Veronica's story. We tried really hard to sort of leave it open because that's where she was when we finished filming with her. But it's a really complicated logistical, ethical, and creative challenge for sure.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And so Matter of Mind, my Parkinson's, as I said at the top of our conversation, is the second in a series. The first covered ALS. What's up for number three?
The third film will focus on Alzheimer's disease. And so we're just nearing the end of production on that third film, and we'll be editing it over the course of this year. And that one will be released in 2025.
Okay. All right. Well, I have been talking to the co-directors of a film called Matter of Mind, My Parkinson's. It will be broadcast on PBS as part of the Independent Lens series on April the 8th. The co-directors I've been speaking with are Anna Moot-Levin and Laura Green. I appreciate your time, and I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Thank you.